So, good morning to everybody, and tēnā koutou katoa. What a great clip that is, hey? Ooh, what a big help we have with our different media we have today to help us bring things to clarity. Last week, Andrew did a great job of introducing this topic of famous for failure heroes of our faith. And this week and the next couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at some equally interesting characters. And he helped us to think about the seeming contradiction of a person who may be on the one hand a hero of the faith and on the other hand a rotten failure. Although Deborah is one of the heroes that we're going to be looking at, the account we're focusing on today, as we've seen, is about a few people and how their lives were interwoven into this situation and these incidences that were part of the history of Israel and therefore a part of our own heritage as God's people. So we will be looking at Barak and Sisera. They say, I might fall back into saying Sisera, so the same guy, Heber and Jael, and of course Deborah. And the clip that Leanne organized for us did outline the story, but I really do also want to read the story from the Bible. There are a couple of details that it leaves out, it will just be really good to reiterate it. So you may know or you may not know, but I have included a few people to help us in the telling of this story. Can you look under your seat? And if you've got a colored piece of card under there, you're in. If you're in and you don't want to be, pass on to someone else. And if you're out and want to be in, then just join forces. So when you hear your part, any mention of something similar to what's on your piece of paper, it's up to you to stand up and show us. So we're in Judges chapter 4. I just wonder, that's a bit louder. How do we turn this? Oh well. After Ehud died, Ehud was the judge who preceded Deborah. The Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord sold them. The Lord is at the back there, yeah. You have to look around while we read. Sold them into the hands of Jabin, a king of Canaan who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Say after me, Sisera. Because he had 900 iron chariots and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried to the Lord for help. Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth. was leading Israel at the time. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the Israelites came to her to have their disputes decided. She sent for Barak. Son of Abinoam from Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun. So those are the tribes, a couple of the tribes of Israel, and lead the way to Mount Tabor. I will lure Sisera the commander of Jabin's army and his chariots, 900 of them, and his troops to the Kishon River and give him into your hands. Barak said to Deborah, if you go with me, I will go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. Very well, said Deborah. I will go with you. But because of the way you're going about this, the honor will not be yours. For the Lord will hand Sisera over to Jael, a woman. So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh, where he summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. 10,000 men followed him, and Deborah also went with him. Now, Heber the Kenite had left the other Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent by the great tree in Zananim. It's at the back, near Kadesh. When they told Sisera that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera gathered together his 900 iron chariots and all the men with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River. Then Deborah said to Barak, go, this is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you? So Barak went down Mount Tabor, followed by 10,000 men. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and his chariots. No, 900 chariots. Oh, yes, they are. Sorry. And army by the sword. And Sisera abandoned his chariot and fled on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. All the troops of Sisera fell by the sword. Not a man was left. Sisera, however, fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, because there were friendly relations between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the clan of Heber the Kenite. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, come in, my lord, not that lord, come in, my lord, come right in, don't be afraid. So he entered her tent, and she put a covering over him. I'm thirsty, he said. Please give me some water. She opened a skin of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him up. Stand in the doorway of the tent, Sisera told Jael. If someone comes by and asks you, is anyone in here, say no. But Jael, Heber the Kenite's wife, picked up a tent peg. And a hammer, and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. She drove the tent peg through Sisera's temple into the ground, and he died. Barak came by in pursuit of Sisera, and Jael went out to meet him. Come, she said, I will show you the man you're looking for. So he went in with her, and there lay Sisera with the tent peg through his temple, dead. On that day, God subdued Jabin, the Canaanite king, before the Israelites. And the hand of the Israelites grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, the Canaanite king, until they destroyed him. Well done. Thank you, everybody. That was great. So, you can see it's a story of tremendous action and needs a little bit of pulling apart and analysis. So here we go. Andrew also mentioned last week that this era of history of Israel was sandwiched between the time of the patriarchal leaders ending with the death of Joshua and the monarch. It was a time of instability and war. So God was trying to get a simple message into the minds of his people. Love God and have no other gods. Sound familiar? Sound simple? Perhaps unsurprisingly, the Israelites just weren't getting it. Well, at least they seemed to get it for a while, and then somehow they went to pot and forgot all they knew or simply ignored what they knew. To remind them of the basics, Israel had a number of seriously ferocious neighbors who frequently attacked and subdued them. And special godly leaders known in the Bible as judges were then placed in charge of certain things. Some of them were military leaders. We'll look at some of those in the weeks to come. And some, like Deborah, were like civil or legal advisors who were expected to listen to and adjudicate the disputes of the people. Now, Deborah is also described as a prophetess, which suggests a closeness to God and an ability to listen to him, to convey his instructions to others, and to live a godly life as an example. And the story said, you know, she always made the right choice. And when the Israelites followed the guidance of the judges, God often assisted them to victory over their oppressors. But then when the current judge died, they slipped back into loving the gods and the ways of the Canaanites until another leader was appointed. And they seem to be stuck in this monotonous and repetitive cycle of being able to love and follow God sometimes and then going abysmally wrong. And the children's story presents it wonderfully simply, but of course, real life isn't as simple as that. And we are all a combination of faithfulness and failure. So let's look a bit more closely at Deborah. What was she really like? Now, we know very little about her. So I've tried to combine a little bit of what I've read around the story, what I've read in the Bible, and some imagination. We know she was married to Lapidoth, but we don't know anything about him except that he had a rather funny name. We know that there were a few other women called prophets. So there was Miriam, the sister of Moses, Huldah and Noadiah in the Old Testament. Heard of them? And then Anna, who lived just before Jesus and at the time of Jesus, and apparently the four daughters of Philip the evangelist mentioned in Acts. So those are some of the women who we know have been prophets in Bible times. But I do wonder what it would have been like for Deborah. In her day, we imagine that success for a woman was measured in one's ability to be attractive to a husband, preferably early on in your life, and preferably one who could support you well. To get married early and to bear many children, particularly sons. If you were successful in this and you happened to survive childbirth and a range of other diseases and disasters, you might have a number of servants to help you manage your household chores, which would include cooking on a fire, sewing, maybe weaving, washing, drawing water, breastfeeding, growing, harvesting, and processing food, or maybe moving regularly to find new pastures for your husband's animals. The successful woman of those times was attractive, astute, hardworking, fit, kind, faithful, and obedient. So how come Deborah got to sit under a palm tree and decide people's disputes? How come God chose her to be his leader at this time when the Israelites had been oppressed by the Canaanite king Jabin for 20 years? The Bible doesn't suggest she was a widow, nor that Lapidoth was an awesome house husband. And we don't know if they were childless or old enough to have adult children. We don't know what she looked like or whether she could cook or sew or not. We don't know if she was a success in her culture, in her time, or a failure and a bit on the outer. What we do know is that God chose her to lead Israel as a judge, and we do know that she took the job seriously. And we also know that she was a feisty and decisive woman of action. So now let's look a bit at Barak. He was the commander of the Israelite army. I guess they were largely a citizen army of tribesmen, many trained informally through years of conflict with neighboring armies. And in this story, he commands 10,000 men from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun to come and fight. And they do. No questions asked. So this is a man of power and authority and experience. Young men jump when he tells them to. Perhaps he was tall, dark, and athletic with strong muscles and great coordination. Or perhaps he was more of a strategist with more brains than brawn and perhaps beady eyes. Or maybe he was a pleasing combination of both. However, it's Deborah who summons him and tells him that the Lord is commanding him to get his warriors ready on Mount Tabor to go into battle against the Canaanite army led by Sisera. And Barak does what she says. Not only this, but he refuses to do the job without her coming along too. Now, on the one hand, Deborah might represent to him the presence of God at the battle, thus ensuring God's assistance and blessing. And we can applaud him for his wise choice then. But the Bible account of Deborah's reaction to this suggests something else. The implication is that Barak is fearful of Sisera and his army. And who can blame him, really? I mean, who of us has really ever fought in a war? Anybody here? No. I mean a real one, a real, you know, war with weapons. But he is the boss after all, this Barak. He is the fighting man's fighting man. And Deborah has promised to lure Sisera and his men and chariots to the Kishon River and to deliver them into Barak's hands. So what more could you want, really? Deborah is horrified by his response. I wonder if she was tempted to call him shame and humiliation, a girl. Instead, she says that even though the Israelites will be victorious, it will in the end be a woman who brings about the demise of Sisera. And it will go down in history to be remembered for all time. I mean, this happened 3,000 years ago, and we and many other people know about it. Her response represents the attitudes to women of her times, and maybe, though we wouldn't want to admit it, our times too. So that's Barak, quick outline of him. Now let's go to Sisera. He had 900 iron chariots. It was the Kenites who were the ironmongers who made these chariots. Now they were descendants of Moses' brother-in-law and had long been in allegiance actually with the Israelites. However, this allegiance had changed. Like many business arrangements we can think of, when the opposition could offer them a better deal, I think I left something out. They changed allegiance. The story tells how Heber the Kenite and his wife Jael moved to live in the area, pitching their tent under a large tree. This had to do with the greater profit to be achieved from supplying implements of war instead of hoes and plows and things, I guess. And things haven't changed today either. The whole arms thing brings in a lot of money, doesn't it? And so he changed allegiance. His old allegiance didn't matter anymore. And it's interesting how important things like loyalty and family ties and traditions can sometimes be completely overshadowed by the promise of wealth. Now, these chariots actually play a really key role in the battle because they couldn't be taken up onto the high ground. So that's why the Israelites gathered, according to what Deborah said, up on Mount Tabor. And there the Israelites were able, when the time came, to rush down into the Kishon Valley, which we don't find out in this reading, but actually later on in Deborah's song, we find out that there was a flash flood. And so the river broke its banks and the chariots got stuck in the mud. How exciting. The 10,000 Israelite men were able to vanquish the Canaanites, even though they didn't have these chariots and horses. And all the soldiers were killed, except for Sisera, the brave commander of Jabin's army. Or not. Because he, too, was a fearful man and had fled for his life from the battleground. Now, if we were generous, we would think, actually, we can understand that. We don't blame him. And we can include him in our list of heroes, not of our faith, but of another faith, who had serious weaknesses. However, in his fear, he forgot his manners, and he approached the tent of a woman, something he was prohibited from doing. For in ancient Near Eastern custom, only husbands and fathers were allowed in a woman's tent. Fortunately for him, she forgot her manners too, and let him enter. But unfortunately for him, the serious slip soon cost him his life. Within a short while, he had been lulled to sleep by the lovely, soporific effect of warm, curdled goat's milk. Yuck. And it was tickets for him. Okay, so here we have Deborah, an unusual woman, not quite fitting the mold of her time, perhaps on the fringe to some extent, and certainly different from the norm, combined with two frightened army generals, Barak and Sisera, both unsuccessfully trying to hide gaping chinks in their machismo armor. And Jael, the scheming murderer wife of an unscrupulous nomadic profiteering ironmonger, who not only broke the current laws of hospitality and committed murder, but who also supported the team opposing her husband's choice of allegiance. She was disobedient, wasn't she? That can happen today too, with dire consequences. And it's all in the Bible. Perhaps I'm exaggerating a bit for effect, but hopefully you get the picture. It was, after all, God who arranged the flash flood. He did have something to do with the victory of the Israelites. And they got the message, and they put aside their allegiance to the Canaanite gods for a while, until Deborah died, and then they lost the plot again. But that's another story. So now I think we're familiar with the story, and we've got some idea of who was involved. There are just three things that I want to comment about it. So this story does remind us, as Andrew suggested last week, that God will communicate his love to us and his desire for us to seek him and know him by whatever means and through whoever he chooses, and despite of their or our shortcomings and flaws. When we pray, "Your will be done," we needn't add clauses like "do it this way, not that way," or "don't use him or her." We leave it to God so that he does it his way. Deborah was admittedly only a woman in a patriarchal society. Barak was a scaredy cat disguised as a tiger. And Jael was a decidedly shady, rebellious wife. But good came out of their battle. In the end, Israel was able to turn back to God, to love him, and to have no other gods but him, which after all is what it's all about. In order for God to get us to a certain place, I think he puts in place certain experiences and opportunities and relationships in our lives, even though we have little insight into this. He may well equip us for a role that we will take later on. He may also turn our mourning into dancing as he invites us to stand, dust ourselves off, and follow him after disappointments and setbacks. Without knowing anything about Deborah's or Lapidoth's circumstances, let's just say that they were childless. Can you imagine for a moment how God might have encouraged them out of their sorrow, leading Deborah to another entirely different role from that which was expected of her or by her? And maybe, just maybe, Deborah's dad used to take her as a girl to sit with him when he met to chew the fat with his mates. And there she learnt about worldly issues beyond the home and the skills of discussion and debate, which would stand her in good stead later on. Okay, so I'm guessing, but it's amazing how God uses life experiences to prepare us for a role we may not even imagine will happen. So God uses us and our failures. Secondly, I also think that God doesn't always respect conventions. In fact, I think he is very much in the business of breaking the mold himself. Andrew alluded to the way Jesus empowered women with callings and roles that they weren't expecting and that weren't expected of them in his times. And God continues to call people today to challenge our long-held assertions, beliefs, and traditions. And I think that sometimes we might even find that downright difficult, if not offensive. In Deborah's day, for a battle victory to be attributed to a woman was possibly the most mortifying thing that could ever happen to the commander of any army. And it happened at the hand of God. Perhaps we too will be humbled in our lives by marginalized people in our own community, or people whom we struggle to take seriously. I find it interesting that what might be seen as different or unacceptable in one era may be considered to be a strength or a treasure or a core value in another. Social mores do change. So, for example, in our culture, slaves don't exist in New Zealand. Women have the vote. Maxing out the credit card is common. Endangered species are protected. Some parents allow their children to watch movies above their age restriction. Men can be chefs and do ballet if they choose. Women can be prime ministers, CEOs, and engineers if they choose. Domestic violence and cruelty to animals are outlawed. Freedom of speech is upheld. Universal education is government funded, and everyone who wishes may be legally married. Teenagers continue to binge drink and abuse their bodies in other ways. You don't get killed for being Jewish or black. And youngsters can go on dates without a chaperone. So it's not always been the case. These are things of our society and not necessary of other societies or other times in history. And changes usually come through the vast efforts and battles of handfuls of courageous people, and some of them may be Christians. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there are some things that are truth and essential and vitally important to uphold, and some things that need to be questioned and reevaluated. And usually it's our children who help us to do this, and often there's a surprising amount of emotion involved. But to help us all with this difficult process of being transformed by the renewing of our minds, our attitudes, and our dearly held views, we do have the promised assistance of the Holy Spirit, who will give us the wisdom and the knowledge and the discernment we need to see things a little differently in order to be obedient to God. And maybe that includes being a failure according to what others expect of us. So that's 2 points. And my third one is that I do seriously believe that although God can bring glory out of our flaws and our failings, this doesn't for one second change his attitude to sin. Because we live in a time when tolerance is a prized value, we may be lulled into thinking that our sin doesn't matter to God, that he loves us anyway, no matter what we do. But I believe sin does matter to God. The thing about Deborah was that she listened to what God wanted in their specific situation. The plan included a mountain and a river, real geographic details for God to do his work in. She knew that the leader of the army had to position himself and his men where God could act to bring about a resounding routing of the other guys. If they didn't start up the mountain and head into the river, the chariots couldn't get bogged in the mud. She knew that she had to position herself there too. Otherwise, Barak would do a runner. Today, if we're lucky and we don't live in countries like Syria and Afghanistan, we don't face this kind of battle. But we do all face the battle with sin every day. Sin can really be obvious, and it can also be really sneaky and not so obvious. It can look really ugly, and it can also look delicious and delightful. It may be our sin or the sin of others, or both. Our addictions, our entitlements, our expectations of others, our thoughts, our patterns of behavior, our words, our actions, and our traditions often run deep with sin. And we may know this and we may not know this. And while I think that God loves us even though we fail, he really longs for us to choose not to sin. In order to do this, we need to be a bit like Barak and Deborah and even Jael. We need to know what's what. We need to be aware of what's going on, the specifics of where the enemy is and where we are and how we can maneuver out of tricky situations where we are tempted, in order to keep our godliness intact. And I believe this is important because our primary business is to honor God, but also because sin can do damage. Damage that might take generations to mend. Damage that can put such huge obstacles in our lives and the lives of others that it takes too much to overcome. And God has given us his Spirit to help us face and flummox and flatten sin. And I wonder if we care enough about righteousness to see that it's something really worth our while fighting about, fighting for. So last week, Andrew asked us to think about how we've experienced failure and how God has used us despite our failures. And I thought I would make it personal and share what I thought about in response to this. It may be a slightly superficial example for you, but it has some elements that have helped me understand a bit better about how God can work. And one of the aspects is that it began a long time ago and it's still having repercussions. So for us in our family, when I was growing up, one of our core values, and especially for my dad, was academic success. And fortunately for me, I loved school and I did well, so that was okay. And that was pleasing to him. And I had an older sister, a couple of years older than me, and she also did well. And there was another thing that was highly valued, and this was rationalism and the ability to reason and to be logical and to think. You know, all that stuff that is important to many people. And mathematical ability, in my dad's view, was one of the pinnacles of this. Now, fortunately for me, I really enjoyed maths and I did well at it until I was about 15. And in our school system, we did a thing called higher grade, and that was the top class. And then if you weren't so good, you did standard grade in all our subjects. So I was in the higher grade class and I came into my fifth form year. I think I was 15. And then I very soon discovered that the teacher was quite difficult to understand, and I was getting a bit drowned. The concepts and skills were tricky. I got off to a bad start on the first day because she came in and said, "Now let me look, girls. Yes, I taught your mother, and I taught your mother, and I taught your mother." And I wasn't in that group because my mother grew up in England, and so I was already, you know, a little bit like a second-class citizen there. But these mothers, she taught 30 years ago. So she'd been in the game for a long time. And she was also a skilled musician, and we heard her on the radio from time to time doing quizzes in music. So, in fact, if you didn't succeed in her class, it was really down to your own lack of ability. And I steadily got more and more befuddled, and the problem was that I was too proud and anxious to ask anybody for help. I didn't really want my parents to know, and I didn't want to say in the class, I don't understand, because I wasn't really used to that. So I just carried on and battled on, and the mid-year exam came, and I failed rather badly. And it was the first time that I'd failed anything, and I was extremely thrown by the whole thing. Fortunately, it wasn't an external exam. Those were still some time off. But anyway, the outcome was I was put into the standard grade class with a new teacher. And from day one, I adored this teacher. She was young. She had a little girl of about 3. And she explained things really clearly. And of course, we didn't need to know quite so much. And the other thing was that I learned very soon that on a Saturday morning, she taught poor black children from a neighboring area maths in her garage. And I was a new Christian. And in the society that I was growing up, that to me was an incredibly wonderful and valuable thing for her to be doing. So I admired her as a person, and I ended up training to be a teacher and teaching Zulu children in KwaZulu, rural KwaZulu. And I know that she was one of the people who influenced that decision for me. And I actually did quite well at maths because I could leave out some of the trickier things. But that's not the end of the story. I don't remember discussing this matter any time at home at all. It was just one of those elephants in the room, the fact that I had failed and I wasn't in the top maths class. And my dad never said anything, and my sister never said anything. She'd in fact left home. Now, last year, 2012, so that's 35 years later or something, my sister and I happened to have a conversation about this math teacher. It turns out that she was drowning too, and she wanted to do science as a career. In fact, she's ended up with a doctorate in zoology. So she had to battle on with higher grade maths and pass it adequately. And my dad had helped her. And she said, "I never knew what was going on in that class. Dad taught me and helped me, and that's how I got through." You know how good it would have been if we'd been able to talk about that? And we just, I guess, because of pride or whatever, I couldn't handle it. So, let me see. If we had shared our struggles, we could have shared our journey together. We could have maybe come up with strategies. Maybe Dad could have helped me with maths. Why didn't I ask him? Had he given up on me? I don't know. And of course, above all, we could have laughed at it. So my weakness was not actually being able to admit that I was struggling. I was very competitive about the whole thing. And I do believe that I've learned from this experience, and I think we've responded better to our own children's different abilities and strengths. And I'm definitely going to talk to my dad about it when I next see him. Okay, so I'm finishing. To summarize, the story of Deborah and Barak reminds us that God can bring really good stuff out of pretty dicey people, including you and me, and out of seemingly hopeless situations. Secondly, to get through to us, he might use people and situations who challenge us deeply by breaking the mold of what we expect as acceptable. And thirdly, Even though God accepts our failures and weaknesses, this is not an excuse not to do all we can to avoid sin. And this involves being aware of what sin actually is and finding practical, sustainable strategies to keep us from doing what is destructive to our relationship with ourselves, with others, and with God. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the stories in the Bible that we can relate to today. That even if they might sound strange or unusual, we can find elements of ourselves in them, and we also can see your faithfulness in them. Thank you for your faithfulness to us today. Thank you that all is not lost when we fail. And I pray for each one of us here that we might go from today renewed and reminded of your love. Amen.